Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to NTI's Japan Real Estate Podcast, brought to you, among others, by Humble Bunny, the best bilingual English and Japanese web design and e-commerce implementer here in Japan. If you've got a business, big or small, or are working for a business that needs a better online presence, hit them up on inquisitive@humblebunny.com. Ask to speak with Nate, tell him you heard about the company here on the podcast, and they'll sort you right out at very reasonable prices. You can't go wrong with these guys. Okay, so this episode, this is the one that we've all been waiting for, at least I have. It's a compilation of the last 12 months' most popular episodes. Now, these are the ones that you, our listeners, have been downloading and streaming and listening to more on average since they've been published than any other. And we're going to bring you some of the highlights of these episodes in order of publication. So it's kind of a top hits from the Japan Real Estate Podcast, if you will, starting with 2020 and ending with our annual summary of 2021, or the projections for 2021, rather. And we've got the usual suspects in there, so topics that always seem to strike a chord with you folks in a variety of formats. So interviews with some of our guests here on the show, conversations, Q&A sessions with new clients, updates on the state of the market, some how-to guides, commentary, and even one interview with yours truly, which is actually the first one that we'll listen to. And although I'm just guessing here, but the main reason you might have loved this episode, aside from the interviewer, Andy Stotz, and his deep baritone, is probably because he put me on the spot there and asked me to relate my biggest investment mistake here in Japan. So really the reason you loved it so much is because you get to gloat, right? Let's be honest about that. Nah, just kidding. It was a good interview. And Andrew's podcast, My Worst Investment Ever, is an excellent one, well worth subscribing to. And we'll link to it, of course, in this episode show notes again. And we're also going to be linking to each and every one of these full episodes if you'd like to go back and listen to them. So our first top hit, here's Andrew Stotz and yours truly talking about my very own, slightly embarrassing, slightly amusing, and quite educational beginner error on the My Worst Investment Ever podcast.
The first thing that I wanted to do, we came in, you know, all guns blazing. We know what we're doing. We've been in the property market for a while now. We know all about the globalization, and you know, we've got 3-4 languages between us. And so the first thing we looked at is okay. We sat down with the tenancy leases and we compared the rents that were payable in each and every one of those units. And we noticed that one of the units had slightly lower rent than the others. We're talking about something like $20 or $30 a month, so nothing consequential. But it seemed like the units were all on the same layout, same size. And for us at that point in time, we saw that the lease was about to end. The tenancy lease was about to end or needs to be renewed on that property that seemed to be getting slightly lower rent. And we're talking something like 14% as opposed to 15.5%. So really nothing big. But me, you know, being an Excel sheet kind of guy, I'm like, well, that just doesn't look good. There's no reason for that one not to be making that same amount of rent. And we're only talking about $20 or so a month extra. So we instructed the property manager that when that tenancy lease is about to be renewed, they should raise the rent to bring it up to speed with the other two units. What we didn't know at the time, because this was our first investment here, is that Japan being Japan and the economy being in deflationary mode for the 25 or so years prior to that purchase, you don't raise rents in Japan. You just don't do that. And the other thing, I mean, a tenant would be paying the same rent that they paid when they moved into the property, say 5 or 8 or 10 or even 20 years ago. And they wouldn't ask you to reduce the rent when the contract is renewed, just because for them, any sort of negotiation is considered and feels like a conflict. So Japanese tend to avoid conflict at any cost. So the tenants would never ask for the landlord to reduce the rent. But on the other hand, the landlord would never ask for the rent to be raised when the lease is renewed, and definitely not if salaries and cost of living and everything hasn't been going up as well. But we didn't know that at the time. What we also knew in theory but didn't actually realize in practice is that Japanese professionals are also not very confrontational. So your property manager or your real estate agent or your insurance agent, if they think that you're making a mistake, they wouldn't come right out and say, no, don't do that. Mm. They would maybe make a sort of a vague comment or ask you if you're sure that that's the course of action that you want to take, or they wouldn't even say that that's not a good idea or anything of that sort. So when we instructed the property manager to do that, he sort of asked us, are you sure that might not be the best idea? I wouldn't recommend it. And we said, no, we know what you're doing. Just tell him that and raise the rent. It's only $20. Not a big deal. And what happened was, is that the tenant just promptly moved out, right? So they did not renew the lease. What they ended up doing was probably move to another vacant unit in the very same building that was at that time renting for about half the rent. Mm. And we stayed with a vacant unit. And the second thing we learned straight after that is that Japanese property managers are professional and polite. All professionals here are professional and polite. They wouldn't swindle you or cheat you or go out of business and take your cash with them or any of that sort of thing. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're not salesmen or that they're going to give you complete and full disclosure and give you the best professional advice, because they are at the end of the day salesmen and they want to sell. And what we found out is that the city in which we purchased those units, Kitakyushu, is actually not the best probably spot to pick for a beginner investor like ourselves. It's a very blue collar town. There are a lot of new developments coming up there that are being priced rental-wise at a very similar price to the older developments. So tenants have a lot more options. And the population there, while not in sharp decline, is just about stable or slightly dropping. So it's not the best profile city in the world to invest in. Mm. And we ended up with a vacancy that took us, I think from memory, about a year and a half to fill again. Which was quite painful. At that time, that was 33%, like a third of our income stream. So that was quite a hit for our investment income stream. So that was quite a financial hit for us as well. We ended up populating it at a much lower rent amount and then just sold it at, I think, about 20 or 30% loss compared to when we bought it. So yeah, that was quite painful, but the good lessons learned.
Well, what were the lessons that you learned from this?
I think we talk a lot about due diligence, right? And due diligence does tend to be, in our minds, due diligence tends to be a very practical sort of numbers related matter. So we look at income streams, we look at risk factors in the sense that, you know, something might suddenly, there might be an unexpected expense down the road, or things could be going better or not as good in particular locations. But we don't really think about cultural and emotional differences when we're dealing in another country. So yes, the numbers probably apply the same anywhere you go, but there are a lot of other factors that you need to take into account. And relying on your knowledge that was gained in another location when you've been investing in your backyard might be not really applicable, might be stark opposite of the place that you're going into next. So I guess due diligence also should include learning about the professionals that you're dealing with and learning to trust their advice, and trying to read between the lines when they say something, or trying to gauge what it is that they might be trying to say to you but are maybe avoiding for various reasons. Mm. I guess listen more would be the most important thing.
Yep, got it. Well, here's some of the things I take away. I mean, the first, there's a great saying in English, we say, let sleeping dogs lie. Like, don't poke at a dog that's comfortably sleeping or you could get bitten.
Absolutely.
So that's kind of the first one. I think the other thing about for newbies in the area of property, particularly rental, they oftentimes forget about the damage that can be done by having, you know, downtime in between tenants. And that can destroy what looks like a beautiful yield. It also reminds me, a third thing is, you know, we have to be very careful as kind of, as you said, Excel experts and, you know, that type of, you know, person that's a numbers-based person. One of my great teachers, Dr. Deming, taught us that really the most important the most important things oftentimes in business are unknown and unknowable, or maybe unmeasurable. And so sometimes we think we can measure it in a spreadsheet, but the human nature of the actual outcome of what we think is the right decision can be very, you know, very different. And then the third thing is, I think in Asia, one thing I've learned is, if you get a little bit of resistance, stop and listen, as you said. Whereas in the West, if we get some resistance, you know, part of what we want to do is get tough and push through it and all that.
It's a challenge.
Yeah, exactly. But in Asia, because you're never going to get the same amount of resistance you would get, let's say, in the West, a tiny amount of resistance is a signal that we have to be much more attuned to and stop pushing something through and ask the question, okay, why am I getting this little bit of resistance? And I think that probably one of the biggest mistakes that people make coming to Asia from the West is that they push through and think, you know, let's get this done. And that can be a huge mistake. So those are some of the things I take away. Anything you would add to that?
Absolutely. I mean, everything you've said is spot on. And we've since obviously learned that. And when we, these days, when we provide the same sort of service for our customer, this was 8 years ago now, these are exactly the things that we look at. So we try to let people know that when somebody, a professional that you're working with, is telling you, that could be a little bit difficult, that should throw out all the possible red flags. That just a little bit difficult is not an invitation to a dance. It doesn't mean, okay, let's do this. It's quite the opposite of that. I mean, if you were anywhere else in the world, then there would be a lot of resistance coming in at this point. So you really want to stop and listen and try to understand what that person is trying to say to you.
Right. So as Andrew summarized it at the end of that talk, and I do recommend you go and listen to it if you happen to have missed it, it'll be in the show notes. When in Asia, talk less, listen more. Absolutely spot on. All right. So our next most popular episode from last year is also an interview. And this one's with Christopher Dillon, originally from Canada, now based in Hong Kong. Now, Chris runs a successful business communication training firm, and he's also director of the Canadian Academy of Independent Scholars. He's a regular speaker in many events, and he's routinely interviewed for a whole bunch of business and news media channels. But what we were most interested in for the purpose of the interview is the series of property guides that he's written, covering a variety of countries all around the world, Japan included. And we talked about all things related to Japan's property market, how it compares with others, and similar to the previous chat, what exactly is involved in conducting due diligence before purchasing here. So here are some highlights from that interview with Christopher Dillon. Back to Japan, which is basically our focus here on the podcast. How does it compare to other Asian markets on all of these fronts that you discussed? I mean, your book touches on a lot of the stuff that we've already spoken here on the show many times. So natural disasters and depreciation, the abandoned homes and the deaths with the aging population and so forth. But there's also a lot of stuff there that even I, you know, being someone who lives and breathes this sector on a daily basis, I didn't know much about. So stuff like the buraku you mentioned, which are Japan's historical, the social menial labor outcasts, and they've got their own little wards that are obviously treated differently, at least by Japanese buyers and sellers.
Yes.
Any other sort of things that you think first-time foreign property buyers should be aware of?
Well, yeah, it really depends. I mean, if you are, and when I say it depends on how much you know. I mean, if you're like a lot of the friends that I have and had in Japan who are foreigners who've lived there for a while, you've absorbed a lot of the cultural and sort of background information just by, you know, living and breathing there. But if you're new to Japan, I really strongly recommend that you immerse yourself in, you know, read the newspaper every day, improve the quality of your spoken Japanese so that you can pick up on the cultural cues and really understand what's going on around you. The more you learn and the more you know about the society that you're buying in, the stronger your position is going to be. We have a tradition here in Hong Kong of real estate developers will show up and they'll rent a function room at one of the high-end hotels in central Hong Kong, and they'll sell homes to people who in countries where the buyer has never been to. And this has always been a source of total amazement to me, that people would buy in a place that they hadn't visited, didn't know anything about, and basically just buying blind. So the more you know, the stronger the position that you're going to be in. There's a lot of things that I really like about Japan. Like, for example, as a foreigner, you face almost no restrictions on buying land in Japan. I mean, there are some things in terms of watersheds in Hokkaido and facilities, land near military facilities. But in general, it's very, very easy, and there are very few restrictions on foreigners buying land. And you compare that with, say, Thailand, the Philippines, and Indonesia, where it's all but impossible for foreigners to buy land. The same goes for Hong Kong and China. All of the land in Hong Kong, except what's underneath St. John's Cathedral in Central, is owned by the government, and you don't own it. You just have it on a long-term lease, anywhere from 50 years to, in the case of my apartment here in Hong Kong, it's on a 999-year lease, which is virtually owning. Same thing with China. The state owns all of the land, so you can't own it. So that gives Japan actually quite a big advantage that way. And another big advantage that Japan has is the fact that as a foreigner, you are not treated differently from a tax perspective. So if you take a place like Singapore, if you're a citizen, you pay one rate of tax when you buy. If you are a permanent resident, you pay a different rate of tax. And if you're a non-resident, you pay an even higher rate of tax. Whereas Japan is blind to that. So as a foreigner coming in to buy, I find that to be very, very reassuring.
Yeah. And obviously, I mean, if you're buying for your own use, a holiday home, like you're saying, in a country that you've never been to or haven't been to frequently enough to understand, that's obviously a concern. But let's say you're buying as an investor and you're looking at a foreign country. Obviously, you might be spreading your portfolio over a few countries, so there's no way that you could really be intimately familiar with each and every place, nor could you be there physically to handle the transactions and the tenancies and so forth. So what would you advise to, let's say, a foreign investor who's been reading your books and other resources out there and has pinpointed a particular country that they're interested in? How would they manage that sort of thing remotely?
Well, so the first thing is, if you are going to do it hands-on, you really need to take a cold, hard look at how much of your time you're willing to devote to that process. If you are going to, you know, for example, I'm sitting in Hong Kong and I own property in Japan, that requires bandwidth, mental bandwidth for me to actually do that. And you need to ask yourself, is owning property directly the best way to do it? It, in fact, might make sense, might make more sense for you to own a REIT like I've done in China, because that's something that's it's divisible and it's liquid. I could sell, you know, 10 of the shares in that. I could sell my whole holding. I can increase my holding, whereas obviously you can't do that with an apartment. And there are other ways that you can go about that as well. You can buy shares in developers. You could buy emerging market debt, for example. There's lots of ways you can do it. You don't physically have to own the property to do it. If you are going to go down that route, you know, make sure that you know what you're getting yourself in for. So I would say, you know, go get some dirt on your shoes, walk around, learn as much as you possibly can about the country, about the city, right down to the neighborhood, because the more you know, the better placed you're going to be. And the research part of it is really hard to overstate, simply because people get an idea in their head and they're going to buy, and if they haven't actually done the research, they don't really know how good a deal they're getting. And using the example again of the shows that come here to Hong Kong, I've seen Japanese properties sold here, you know, in some of these shows that basically it was junk. It was stuff that had been picked over in Japan. I don't think anybody in Japan would have bought it. Yield wasn't great. Location wasn't great. But here in Hong Kong, everything is so expensive that it actually looked like a good deal.
And that, again, was Christopher Dillon, author of the Landed series of books, Global Country-Specific Property Guides, highly recommended. And we'll link to the books page and to the entire conversation in this episode show notes as well. Now, moving right on, and to hammer home Christopher Dillon's point regarding due diligence in relationships and partnerships, another of your favorite episodes from last year was this chat that we had with one of our then potential clients, now a fully engaged client, who's purchased some Japanese ski holiday properties on his own with the notion of potentially renting them out as short-term stay accommodation in his absence, only to find out things were not exactly as they seemed. Here's a segment from that call.
Okay, so you've purchased there and you've been using it just for your own purposes, or have you been leasing it out as well?
Yeah, so I purchased two apartments here, thinking whether it would be possible, well, thinking that I would possibly rent out one apartment during the winter time. You know, if I wanted to use the apartment in winter, which I did, but I also wanted to get some income to cover the relatively high management fees. However, the issue is that a lot of the buildings here, when you purchase the properties, they have as a clause of purchase, as a part of the building property rule, that you can't short-term lease.
Correct.
Yeah, that's a big issue. Now, I didn't understand how serious and how difficult the situation is, but there was a Japanese investor who purchased five or six properties in the same building, and they, you know, they wanted to Airbnb, and they actually somehow got an Airbnb permission. They got a hotel permission.
Yep.
And the condo board has now taken them to court to fight that. So.
Well, the legislation.
It's a very serious thing. Yeah.
The legislation changed in mid 2018. They've given building management companies and the owners co-ops the authority to prohibit this.
Yeah.
So okay. Even if somebody had a license, if somebody had a license even from before, the license might not be officially cancelled, but the building management company can definitely tell them to stop.
Yeah, which was, I was surprised about that. You know, to be honest, I was very surprised that, in a sense, the building co-op has a lot of power. and, you know, I'm fine with it, you know, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. But seeing, wow, it's, and then I've gone to a few co-op meetings where a lot of the local Japanese, they are very angry. Like, they really do not want short-term leasing in resort condos.
Yeah, they're ridiculous.
Even though it's really affecting, it really affects the property values, the resale values of these buildings.
Oh, the whole economy of the town. I mean, these are tourist towns, right? Like the idea of not allowing tourists to rent in the town is just preposterous. But Japan's old-fashioned that way.
I mean, I can understand. Being an owner here, I can understand from both perspectives. You know, having lots of strange, like what they say, strange guests who no one knows anything about coming in and possibly damaging the property, you know, which all the owners then have to pay for repairs and everything. I can understand that. At the same time, being in a resort town where the economy is primarily based on tourism and not being, and, you know, pretty much not having any short-term leasing, and the hotel, you know, the hotel options here are very limited as well. But so I think that's why most of the people that come to my area, they're only here for a weekend. Luckily, the Shinkansen is very good. There's two Shinkansen here, so the transport here is very convenient and good. But I was surprised. I'll be honest with you, I was surprised. The stance that, sort of like, may I say, civil war that's going on in my building. it's a very cultural thing as well. I think that, you know, in my building it's half owned by foreigners, half owned by local Japanese. I find that the foreigners are more open to, you know, short-term leasing, Airbnb, things like that.
Yeah.
Whereas the local, the Japanese, and I can understand their position. I mean, you know, they bought these properties during the bubble era, you know, when the properties were super expensive. Obviously, you know, the foreigners are more open to short-term leasing for the investment sake, whereas the original Japanese owners, they're totally against it. And the reason I'm really surprised is during the, building condo meetings where they discuss these, the annual meeting, you know, Japanese and Japan are very polite and well-mannered. Wow, those meetings got very heated.
Really?
Lots of swearing. I've never seen Japanese swearing and telling, you know, the other Japanese Airbnb investor to literally swearing, get out of this building, get out of this town. It was really heated.
Did you not know that about these restrictions when you purchased the properties?
I knew there were restrictions on Airbnb. And to be honest, I'm not too fussed because I wasn't really looking to make money from short, you know, Airbnb or things like that. What I was thinking though is, you know, when I have friends or business colleagues or clients from, you know, Hong Kong, China, Asia, they'd love to come to Japan. And I was thinking at that time, well, you know, if I have two places, which happens, you know, I can short-term lease to my friends, my colleagues, my, you know, other family members.
Well, that should still be doable, no? I mean, you can.
That's what I thought.
Not the rent part. Yeah. I mean, that would be between you and them. But you're allowed to let your friends and family stay there, right?
Yes, I'm allowed to let my friends and family stay there. But because of this court case that's now going on between the building management and the Airbnb guy, the police got involved. That's why I can't believe how serious it got. You know, the local police got involved, and they're now doing an investigation of who's been renting, who hasn't been renting, and sending, you know, warning notes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, if I have friends or cousins, you know, clients, or family that stay here, I want them to, you know, if they're staying here for a while, I want them to be contributing to the electricity costs and things like that, right?
Yeah, somebody comes knocking on their door to ask them what they're doing there and how they got there is not pleasant, is it?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And, you know, if they get warning letters and they, you know, have to explain that they're, you know, my family or my friends, it's really difficult. You know, it's not ideal for me.
Mm-hmm.
But luckily, you know, I wasn't planning. I wasn't required, you know, I didn't really purchase the property as an investment, as a rental investment vehicle. It was more for my own enjoyment and my own use. I was actually hoping in the future that position would change in order for my investment, you know, my property investment to, you know, have more options in terms of capital appreciation and in terms of, you know, rental income. But to be honest, I don't think it's going to happen.
I don't think so, no. I mean, even if it could just cover the monthly fees, that would be good. But we've seen it getting worse, not better. I got to be honest with you.
It's getting worse and not better. You're totally right.
Yeah.
You're totally right. I may have looked into this a bit more carefully. Probably I would have just gotten one property if I known the situation would be like this. I'm still very glad that it's a wonderful place, and the price was amazing. And it's a wonderful building and the community is really great. So I don't regret making the purchase, but management fees can be quite high in these buildings.
Yeah. They're usually about $200-$300 a month each, right?
No. I've got a 50 square meter. That's about 300 US.
Yeah.
300 US a month. And then I've got a 70 square meter, a larger 70 square meter. Okay. That's about 600.
Oh, wow. US a month. Oh my God. Okay.
Yeah. So, actually more about 400 or 500. But when you add in, it's not only the management fee, you have the repair fund you have to contribute to, which is quite expensive. And I've got to say, the electricity and water costs here are quite high.
In the countryside, they are, yeah.
Yeah, in the countryside, yeah. Mm. And I tell you, there's no insulation here is pretty poor. So you pretty much, unless you get double glazing and stuff done, which I know a lot of people have, wow, their gas bills add up really quickly. I think I had one month, during the dead of winter, most people get a gas bill of about $200 US a month. Oh. $200, $300 a month.
So what's the plan moving forward? What are you going to do with them?
So it's still quite, I mean, moving forward, I might sell off the larger apartment.
Yeah.
I might sell off the larger apartment, because I really can't justify, it's only me, so I don't really need two apartments.
Mm.
And keep the smaller apartment just to enjoy myself, when I need to come back into Japan during my visa runs or short work breaks, or when I come here for snowboarding. I'll probably keep the smaller one. Also, the smaller one, the building management fees, because they're charged by square footage, the building management fee is much more reasonable.
Yeah.
And repair fee is much more reasonable. And, being one person, I don't use up the whole space of the larger apartment.
Yeah.
And also the heating and electricity costs. For example, I've got two inbuilt gas heaters on the larger room compared to one. So my gas bill in the larger room is basically doubled.
Okay.
I'll probably keep the smaller one, but sell the larger one. Right now it's not urgent. Because, right now we're in spring summer. So I heard if I'm selling in spring summer, it's really, the prices are significantly lower. And a lot of people, I've noticed in this area, wintertime, people don't really sell properties in winter. All the families use the property during wintertime. And as soon as spring summer comes, then they sell them off.
Yeah, it's also a bit of a problem for agents to bring people up there to have a look in the winter.
Yeah.
Really? Yeah, accessibility can sometimes be an issue. Not everybody can and does have the... because agents like to take people over by car, but if they don't have the facilities to drive around there, it's a bit more difficult.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's interesting. Because I have noticed... I talked to my agent that he said that he mostly sells all his properties in the spring and summertime.
Yeah.
That's quite interesting. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So how can we help? What did you need? Obviously, we can't help you with tenants. I'm sorry about that.
That's fine. When I purchased the property, I tried to research as much as possible. The one thing I didn't take into account was how to manage the property post-purchase. What I mean by that is, in Australia, in Hong Kong, in China, when you purchase a property, it's relatively simple to, get utilities set up, to get a property agent to help manage your property and to get bills paid. What I didn't realize is In Japan, it's much more difficult. And yes. What I mean by that is, for example, my monthly building management fee and repair fund contribution. In Australia, in Hong Kong, they'll send me an invoice and I'll, pay it by my card or I'll do a bank transfer.
They'll email you an invoice, you mean?
And they'll email me, they'll email or mail me an invoice.
No, that doesn't happen here.
It doesn't happen here. No. I never thought, it just didn't occur to me.
I'm so sorry about this, mate.
Yeah. And so for my building, they only do direct debit for building management and...
From a Japanese account.
Repair fund. Yeah, from a Japanese bank account. In order to get a Japanese bank account, I need to have a Japanese residency visa, do you mention?
Yep.
So even though I can purchase a property, so the irony is, it's very easy to purchase a property here as a tourist, but it's very difficult to pay any of your bills. So
correct.
That's my problem. I thought I would find a real estate agent who could, in Australia or wherever, or Hong Kong, you just find a real estate agent and they'll handle it for you.
Yeah.
Most of the real estate agents that I talk to, they only handle properties in Tokyo, Osaka, major cities.
Yep.
They don't deal in countryside, in other areas, which I was very surprised.
This gap that you run across between the official country policy and the practical on-the-ground practices is exactly the reason that we've been in business.
You're pretty much the only guys, I think, that deal with this. Because, I've contacted a few property management companies in Tokyo, everywhere. Tokyo, Osaka, Japanese companies with branch offices in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
No one, pretty much either they say they can't handle it or they've referred me to you. That's how I was able to get your but to be honest, I knew about you from your blogs, which were very useful. So when I was doing my research to purchase a property, I was listening to your blogs. I should have listened more, obviously. but most of the property companies in Tokyo basically referred me to you to discuss how to handle the practicalities of owning a property in Japan.
So
we can
do all of this. That's what we do for our clients on a regular basis. What we're going to do is we're going to be, you're going to give us authority to act in Japan on your behalf.
Okay.
And then we're going to be the contact person for the building management company and the tax department and anybody else that can't, wrap their heads around sending statements overseas or receiving money from overseas.
Yeah, okay, awesome. Because the other issue I've been having is that when I contact... Okay, so that's with the building management. With my utilities, my electricity and my gas, they don't send bills overseas. They don't even email bills.
No.
They send a card that to my building, which I then need to go to 7-Eleven. They don't have online payment facilities,
correct,
which is really, that's my head in. So I have to go to 7-Eleven. The issue is, if I'm not in Japan, I can't pay for my gas. I can't pay for my electricity. I call them up, and it's very... no one speaks Japanese and no one speaks English. I know I'm in Japan. I need to know Japanese. But it's very difficult as an English foreign speaker to totally have no English contact with the utility company as well.
Yeah.
I can't even explain my situation because they don't speak English.
Yeah,
when you call up the helpline. Yeah.
Same goes for City Hall and the tax department in most places as well.
Yeah. So, if you could assist me in handling these sort of day-to-day issues, I'd be very grateful.
Yes, so all's well that ends well. We did take over and help this frustrated buyer with his management, or rather his lack of ability to manage situation. And he's now far less stressed, I'm happy to report. Haven't heard from him regarding selling off one or both of these properties, but we should be able to assist him with that when the time comes as well. And just about the same time as when this episode was recorded, all hell broke loose. The rumors regarding a strange and highly contagious flu-like virus that spread out of China became a reality. Flights and international travel ground down to a halt. The Tokyo Olympics have been cancelled or at least postponed. And we've started seeing some very interesting, highly discounted properties become available for purchase in places such as Tokyo and Osaka at prices that we at least haven't seen for a good few years. Our clients were quick to react, and for that reason, most likely your next favorite episode of the year was the one we'll hear some segments from now. And really all that was is just a collection of available property listings that were advertised for sale in various central locations around the country that have suddenly become far more affordable due to the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic. So here it is, some excerpts from our Corona Bounty episode. First and foremost, some cheaper residential condo units, mansion rooms, as they're known here. And we'll start with Tokyo and surrounding areas. So we've seen one unit in Funabashi City, which is a medium-sized city, just over 620,000 people, population on the rise, actually fast on the rise, which is quite rare for Japan, major commercial center and bedroom community to Tokyo itself. So it's only 36 minutes by train from central Tokyo. Just under 1 hour to Narita International Airport. And this one is pretty luxurious. So family-sized unit on the sixth floor of a nine-floor reinforced concrete block. Two bedrooms plus living room, dining room, kitchen, what's known as a 2LDK here. Heated floors, tatami mat, bedrooms, built-in closets, cupboards in each and every room. And the building, which was built in 1991, even comes with parking spots, which is really rare in large metropolitan centers in Japan. It's about 70 square meter in size, so again, family-sized unit, and it's listed at 27 million Japanese yen, which is about 250,000 US or so, tenanted and generating about 6% net pre-tax. Now, I don't know if you've been following our podcast or the market in general or not, but if you have been, I probably don't need to tell you how rare it is to find any property of this size and age that generates this kind of yield. Let alone a property that's this close to central Tokyo, which is arguably the most expensive spot in Japan. So that's just one example of what we've been seeing on the residential front here. If you're going for something a bit smaller, older, more suburban, we've seen one in Hachioji City, again next to Tokyo, actually officially in the greater Tokyo metropolitan area as opposed to the first one, even though it's actually about an hour to the west of central Tokyo. So further, just under an hour by train to Shinjuku, Shibuya, the central western districts, which are probably the city's best-known business and fashion hubs, respectively. This one is a studio unit, and it is, let's see, just under 19 square meter in size, balcony facing east, so plenty of sunlight, and it's listed, are you ready for this, for 3 million yen. So we're talking about 28,000 or so US dollars, tenanted. Again, most of the units that our clients ask us to research for them are tenanted because they prefer to buy turnkey straight into income generation, not into expenses. And this one is yielding, hold on to your horses, 9.6% net pre-tax yield per annum, right? So 28,000 US dollars to buy. Net pre-tax annual income, just over 3,300 US or so, which including all purchase costs works out to be just under 10% net pre-tax. Now, this one probably has less capital growth potential than the Funabashi property, just because Hachioji is a bit further from central Tokyo compared to Funabashi. Also, Hachioji's population is stable, but not really growing much. And it also has less going for it industries, economy-wise. So it really is only a bedroom community to Tokyo, and no other industries to speak of. Although it's a pretty big one as satellite towns go, so well over 500,000 people. But, I mean, 28,000 US is just insane. And again, nothing that we've seen in this area for well over 4 or 5 years. Okay, one more maybe in that same area, a bit further afield, Maebashi City. Population about 330,000, so a bit smaller than those other two cities, but also growing. It's about an hour and a half north of Tokyo and about an hour north of Saitama, which is the closest biggest city. Now, Maebashi has its own economy, so it's a nice and stable economy there. Regional commercial center again, although more on the blue-collar side compared to Funabashi, so
a lot of manufacturing, agriculture, some traditional arts, similar industries. They're pretty well known for producing tofu, for example, and interestingly enough, for producing traditional samurai helmets. That's still a thing in Japan. And probably because they're also very well known and popular for tourism. They got a lot of greenery, fresh water, and a lot of history. Some pretty famous Japanese poets hailed from Maebashi throughout history, for example. So pretty robust economy, and of course, again, also a bedroom community, not just to Tokyo, but to Saitama City itself. An hour and a half from Tokyo as well is not such a long commute, especially for people who stay in Tokyo during the week, then go back home to their families on the weekend, which is what a lot of Japanese company staffers tend to do. This one was built in 1992. It's a studio unit but with a separate kitchen, so what's called a 1K. About 21 square meter in size, also listed for 3 million yen, so about $28,000 again, and again generating about 9% net pre-tax. Now, this one is on a commercial lease, which means a company has been leasing it since 1995. So the same tenant in place for 25 years. Obviously, nice, stable cash cow there. Although you will want to bear in mind that if and when that tenant does move out, you're probably looking at something like $10,000, $15,000 in renovation costs. So wear and tear after 25 years or more of tenancy can, of course, be quite significant. But a lot of people wouldn't mind that considering the stable commercial tenant that's already in place for so long. And, of course, the price and the location. So there you go. Crisis brings opportunity. And this one's no different. Property investors have been very busy in 2020. And they're not showing any signs of slowing down in 2021 so far. And neither should they, considering that as the vaccines have started rolling out, the current state of affairs might slowly come to an end or at least start improving slightly, which is what we all hope for, of course. So the next few months might be one of the last times we'll see these prices in these locations, at least for the next few years or so. Okay, so now going a bit off topic into the wonderful world of Japanese design, architecture, and carpentry. Your next favorite episode of 2020 was a fantastic conversation that we've had with Anne Kotz, originally from Idaho in the USA, now a resident of Tsukuba here in Japan. And Anne is an architecture student and interior designer turned carpenter turned gluten-free baker. And while we haven't yet had the pleasure of tasting her breads and pastries, we have had the pleasure of having her here on the show, talking all things related to Japanese building techniques, carpentry, and the joys of helping to preserve some of Japan's most beautiful traditional structures. So here are some snippets from that interview.
So I did all kinds of stuff. I mean, I was drawing the plans, but I was also, you know, sometimes running a jackhammer or, you know, mixing and pouring cement or puttying and, you know, prettifying the old beams and things or sanding and painting. I mean, you name it, I probably did it. So, and that's really what works with those old cranky architects and carpenters. I mean, that's what they really, you know, they just really like somebody that can just pick up a tool and use it and doesn't have to be, you know, told everything to do. So yeah. That's a really good thing. I mean, I was asked to serve tweet tea.
No.
Twice, that's all. After that, the word kind of got around, and so I didn't really get asked to do that again. You know, if it's my client, then yeah, I'd serve tea, but I don't serve tea just because a woman ought to do it, you know.
So. Yeah.
And nobody ever actually dared to ask me to make a photocopy.
Or fax, right?
Or fax, oh yeah. Seriously, those guys all use faxes. So, But anyway, you know, the biggest thing that I found was that I just had to learn the language. And that's something that's still just absolutely daunting because, you know, you think you're pretty fluent in Japanese. You get all cocky about your Japanese and your accent and stuff until you have to explain your plans to a 7-year-old Ibaraki Ben speaker who has no teeth. I mean, seriously, those guys are so hard to understand, you know. Sometimes I actually had to get somebody to translate for me, you know, from Japanese to Japanese.
From Japanese to Japanese.
Yes. Because Ibaraki-ben, you know, it's really funny. Ibaraki-ben is so, it's so interesting because they lose vowels. You know, there's in Japanese, traditional, in typical Tokyo Japanese, there's a, i, u, a, o.
Yeah.
But in Ibaraki, they say a, i, e, e, e. They lose like two vowels. It's like, what happened? So I Italian, instead of saying "Iro en pizza," they say "Iro in pizza."
Oh.
Yeah, so it's like really hard to understand. And then, you know, and then a person that has no teeth left, it's like, wow, you know. So and then, you know, and then they would like to have a little bit of fun with me. So, you know, sometimes they'd be like, you know, they knew very well that I had no idea what the Yonsun Gakutsuta or is, you know, what's the, what part of the wood is the Keshomen. I had no, you know, they knew I didn't know
that. Well, everybody knows that.
Yeah, right. So, but they'd have a little fun with me sometimes with that, so. Oh, and also another thing that just was hysterically, you know, it was both really daunting. You have to be able to translate between shaku and sun measurements and centimeters. And, oh. And, you know, I grew up with inches, so there's two translations right there.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, I mean, it just really, I mean, first of all, Americans can go jump in a lake for you still using inches. I think that's stupid. But but anyway, I'm an American, so I get to say that. But anyway, so the shaku and sun thing, it just was really, really, really confusing at first, and then you have to just know all the conversions off the top of your head.
Because well,
you
hopefully none of those measuring mistakes actually went to production, right? You would have picked them up before you actually start banging the wood together, right?
But it is an issue because, you know, you just have to keep it straight, you know. And for me, the biggest issue was that, you know, in a foot and a shaku are almost the same thing, right? But a foot is divided into six, and a shaku is divided into 12, I mean, and a shaku is divided into 10. So half a foot is 6 inches, but half a shaku is 5 sun. So, you know, I couldn't get it through my head that people would be like, hanjaku, hanjaku, and I'd be writing a 6, you know? So, it was, that was a little bit dangerous. But, yeah, nothing, no big problems happened because of that. It was just mostly my time that was taken up. So. Yeah. But anyway, back to Kenshiku Kobo U, I started working over there. And those guys, they're really incredible. And it's not just the carpenters. The tile guys and the roofers and the plasterers and all those traditional tradespeople are just amazing. I mean, like the plasterers, you know, they train with a tub of water. And they have to, they fill the tub of water completely up to the rim. And then they have to practice running their trowel over it without spilling any water. So they have to get the bottom of the trowel wet and slide it across the surface of the water and not spill any over the edge.
That's like martial arts training, isn't it?
It really is. It's just really surprising and it's just really amazing. And here's the other thing. That this illustration, I think, is the most striking to an architect who was trained in the U.S. In a 2x4 house in the U.S., when you frame a window in, you have to factor at least an inch of shin space. That's the open space around the window. So you have to have like an extra inch of space in all sides of where the window is going to fit because the frame is never going to be true. So, you know, you just have to factor that in. So you make the space for the window bigger than what the window is designed to be. And then when they put it in, they shim it up. They put these little supports in and they shim it up so it's straight and true. And then when they finish out the house, then they put trim pieces on it to cover up the opening. And then, you know, they also put insulation in there and they cover everything up. So there's all these trim pieces all over everything. And those are to basically cover up the holes, you know, cover up the spaces. And I tell you what, I was never more shocked. The first house I worked on, I designed the window space, and then I tried to design the frame bigger to have a shim space. And the guys were like, "What are you doing?" And I'm like, "Well, I'm putting in a shim space." And they're like, "What's that for?" I'm like, "Well, that's a shim space." And so what happened was they framed the window to the exact bloody dimensions of the built window.
Really? Not a millimeter apart?
Nothing.
Wow.
And then, so these were wooden windows in that house. And then the window maker came in and he just slid the window exactly into place.
That's amazing. So
it was. I was so shocked. And I just couldn't, you know, at first I couldn't believe it. And then I was like, well, you know, and so the next thing you do in an American construction is you have to caulk around the window, right? And they're like, and I'm like, aren't we going to caulk? And they're like, what are we going to caulk? And I'm like, around the window. And they're like, why would we do that? And so turns out that in a traditional Japanese wooden house, basically the humidity will expand the wood and seal it.
Oh.
So it seals the wood of the window to the frame. So there's no need for caulking. And I'm just like, yeah. So that's just absolutely, I mean, that was just absolutely stunning for me.
The fabulous Anne Kotz. That one is honestly one of my favorite episodes too. We can't feature all of it here on this compilation. Obviously, it's already gone quite long, but it's really an eye opener. And I highly recommend you hop over to the show notes and listen to it from start to finish. If you got a bit of time, really fascinating stuff there and quite a few laughs. Right then. So next to your next favorite, this one is another call with a potential client. And we're talking about small buildings, investing in small residential or mixed purpose or commercial buildings. We give some samples in various locations, mostly in Tokyo, because that was he was interested in. We talk about loans, the ability to get loans as a resident or as a non-resident. And also a little bit about our services and how we can help with the purchase and then management of a property, how much we charge, and so forth. That one's also been downloaded and streamed hundreds and hundreds of times, so apparently you found some value in it. So here are a few segments from that conversation for you.
So something also I would be interesting at looking at in Japan, I've had a quick look in Tokyo. That's totally, well, hard to do.
Not cheap.
Yeah, let's say that. Yeah. Let's say that. I don't really have the time and expertise or the time to build the expertise to look around, I mean, of all the second tier cities in Japan to see where that would make most sense and what kind of, which location would be available for, let's say, a mid-sized budget with a enough visibility as to getting tenants and good cash flow.
When you say mid-sized budget, what kind of budget are we talking about?
Let's say in Tokyo, I haven't found really anything less than $1 million.
Yeah.
And even $1 million, it's not really a good thing. So I'm more thinking around, let's say, 500, 600, this kind of budget.
Okay, well, we just had a bit of a research done for another customer on exactly the same topic. So if you give me a minute, I'll just have a look at the results. And then I should be able to give you some samples of what's doable in other cities. Just give me a sec.
Sure.
Okay, so the cheapest I saw in Tokyo, and this is just a 5-unit building with one office on the ground floor and then 4 residential units on top. And that one is 88 million. So about, let's call it 800,000 US. And then I've got one in Yokohama that's actually quite reasonable. So 4 units, 1 shop, 1 office, and so just 2 floor building, 1 shop. Oh, no, sorry, 4 floor building. It's 1 unit per floor. And you got 1 shop, 1 office, and 2 rooms, 2 1Ks. And that one is 65,800, so just about 660,000 or so?
Yeah, something like that.
That one's residential. Just give me a sec. Okay, there's one in Osaka, which is 77 million, and that one has 1 office and 6 rooms. And you're not interested in completely commercial, are you?
Fully commercial buildings?
Yeah, well, small ones. I mean, just, you know, two offices and one shop, or just a three-floor building with one shop or one office per floor kind of thing.
Taking into account the current situation?
Yeah, businesses are closing these days.
It might be wise to wait a little bit.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, the upside of the current situation is that they are cheaper now.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Okay, and then I've got another one in Tokyo again, just under 89 million, which is one shop and six units.
Okay.
And another one in Tokyo again, same price, 88 million, one office and three residential units.
Mm-hmm.
And another one in Tokyo for 74.5 million, actually. That's the cheapest one. And that was built in 2016. That's a really nice one. One office, four one-room units. That's in Koto.
Koto, yeah.
Yeah. And anything else? So bear with me. Okay, that's just two shops. So Holy Commercial again. And no, that's it. That's what I've got. So maybe Yokohama, maybe even Osaka. I think definitely Nagoya and Fukuoka would probably have deals. Maybe not quite 50 million, but maybe something closer to 60, 70.
Mm-hmm.
That would probably suit what you're looking for. And these were all built 2000 and later, so they're all in pretty good shape.
Interesting.
So it's doable. If you don't mind specifically Tokyo, it is doable. Even in Tokyo, I mean, what's your maximum budget? You said, we said not 10 million, or not 100 million, but what's your maximum?
Yeah, so that would also really depend on the bank as well, because that's not going to be a cash purchase for that. So,
well, I mean, considering the fact that you're going to be buying something that's already more than 50 million, I would guess, it might be a good idea to set up a company.
Yep.
And then even if you don't have residency, you could get a loan from Shinsei Investment and Finance. And that, but the terms wouldn't be as good as a native Japanese loan. So you're looking at somewhere between 3 to 4% interest.
Mm-hmm.
And 60 to 70% LTV. So you will need to put in 30 to 40% in cash. So if that's doable for you, you don't have to wait for residency. They will give you a loan.
Well, I should get the residency in 2 months, so.
Okay, well, that's not an issue. But did your bank actually tell you that they lend for a commercial mixed property?
I have this Aeon Bank. Could be a possibility for that.
Okay.
But it's only 80% loan to value. So I still have to put 2% down payment.
It's not a bad thing, man. It's not good to be 100% leveraged, I'd say.
Well, depends what.
I mean, no, I mean, things go downhill. You're suddenly going to be putting
sure.
up, yeah.
Sure, yeah, that's always a possibility here. Mm. You're right. Well, as well, but... okay, well, I didn't know about the Shinsei on... But okay.
But what's Aeon interest rates like?
Last time I asked them for that, it was around 2.5.
Well, that's not that much worse. That much better than Shinsei. That's only about Shinsei will go 3-3.5%. So it's not a disaster. Okay, so Aeon said that mixed purpose is okay. They don't mind shops and offices and so forth.
I only asked them the general question about the building with mixed use, but I haven't given them too many details. So it's just a pretty okay discussion. There is no, I do not have yet, as you know, since I haven't given them the property, the official loan template.
But they're open to it.
They're open to it. Yeah.
Okay, that's great to hear. Okay.
Using some connections.
Ah, okay, so it's not something you can just walk off the street and get. Probably not.
Probably not.
You should make a business of that one. I know a lot of people that will go for that.
That's a possibility.
All right, so on to your next favorite episode, which again is one of my favorites as well. And this is an interview I've had with Daphne Thompson, whom you may have heard recently again on some of our Clubhouse Japan Real Estate Room conversations. So Daphne is originally from South Africa. She's an experienced property investor herself, and she's a really fun person to talk to. And we talk about, well, lots and lots of stuff, but in this segment that you're going to be hearing, we focus on the current COVID situation and how it's affected various segments in the market, as well as on the new, well, now not so new, short-term stay legislation, aka Airbnb. So a really fun, in-depth conversation, which I hope you will enjoy.
So which property sectors do you think is currently thriving in the COVID situation?
The properties that are most attractive, purchase price-wise, that are most attractive now are ex-hospitality properties. So people who have been running little Airbnb operations and suddenly lost all of their bookings for like 2 years ahead. Retail properties, commercial properties, because a lot of businesses have had to scale down or even close. So people who own these kinds of properties kind of fire selling them now. Little hotels, yokans, like little inns in the countryside, that sort of thing. And generally, like I was saying, the market's a bit softer now, so it's easier to negotiate prices for properties than it was 5 or 6 months ago.
So would you say it's a buyer's market now?
Oh, definitely buyer's market now, yeah.
All right, so for all of our investors out there, this is the time that you should try and find a good deal.
Our clients have been having a field day, yeah, in the last 3-4 months.
That is awesome. So you mentioned the hospitality industry. Japan has a very unique way, like everything else they do, but a very unique way of handling Airbnb. How does that work?
It used to be a bit of a gray area until mid last year, or is it mid 2018 already, when they put in some new legislation? And from that point onwards, they changed a few things. So first of all, they made you jump through a lot more hoops if you want to actually comply and have a license to do it properly.
And so you have to have a license to do that?
Yeah, well, you have to register with City Hall and let them know that you're running an Airbnb. And if you want to rent it out for more than half the year, you do need to apply for an actual hotel license. Which is not that complicated of a process in Japan, but it obviously brings in a lot more compliance issues that you might not have had to think about before. So fire and safety and hygiene, and you need to have a person available on call within a certain distance from the property 24/7, that kind of thing. So it's become a bit more difficult. And one of the most stringent things that they've done is that they've now given owner co-op, so let's say units in a co-owned block, or each unit is owned by a different owner. So they gave the owners co-op and the building management company the right to decide that they're not going to allow Airbnb, or they don't call it Airbnb, they call it Minpaku, which is short-term rental. So basically anything that's done without a lease, like just letting guests in and out kind of thing. And for periods of less than 1 month. So for that, you need approval from building management or from the owners co-op. And I'd say about 99% of them are not allowing that.
Now, would you recommend Airbnb as an investment strategy? Maybe not as a unit, but if you have a full block, would that then be better?
Yeah, so if you own the entire structure, yes, that's definitely a lot more viable. But still, there's compliance. So if you own a building that's only got, say, 4 units in it, so you really have to factor in the cost of compliance. So to make sure that the building satisfies the Minpaku, with the short-term stay legislation, and has all the fire and safety and hygiene and regular cleaning and so forth that comes with that. And the cost of, if you're living in one of the units and you're there, that's okay. But if you're not, if you're a remote investor, then you need to have somebody within a certain distance of the property that's available to take calls. So you just need to factor all of that in and see if it's worth your time. And the other thing is that it's a lot more hands-on, obviously, than just being a long-term lease landlord, right? So you need to take care of check-ins and check-outs and problems and people that pay and don't pay and take bookings and constantly check your occupancy rates and see if you're profitable or not. So it's a full-on job.
So on the one side, it's nice job creation, and the other side is a little bit of a headache.
Yeah, but I mean, it can, when it goes well, it can more than double the rental income you'd get from a normal long-term lease. So it's worth it if you've got the time and the bandwidth to deal with it.
All right. Is there a certain period of time that, so if you've got the hotel lease or the hotel license, the hospitality license, can you lease it all year round? Can you do Airbnb all year round? So if you don't, then it's only a certain amount of time per year.
Under that time frame. So what people often do is they rent it out Minpaku Airbnb for half the year. And then the other half of the year, they put in people with normal leases for something like, say, monthly rentals. So somebody rents the place for a month or 2 months or 6 months. And then they don't fall under that legislation. And that's okay. That's considered a normal lease for the rest of the year.
All right, cool. So this is also Airbnb is a solid strategy with different factors that you need to keep in mind.
Yes, it's not as easy as, say, Europe, Australia, a lot of other places. You got a place, you just rent it out, you book people in and out, and you make sure, I mean, they might be more or less satisfied with what you provided, but you don't have to go through any legal compliance issues, unless anything happens, obviously, but otherwise.
Yeah.
But here, it's not like that. So here, like everything Japanese, at least in the last year and a half or so, you do have to make sure that you're doing everything by the book. Native Japanese who don't really care much about visas and stuff, a lot of them still operate it in a gray sort of area. But for foreigners, it's a risk because if you break the law, they could officially kick you out of the country. So,
of course,
there's been a few Brits in that have actually gone to jail for a couple of weeks in Tokyo, I think, when they ran afoul of that one.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Because one of our investment strategies is Airbnb. So one of our properties, it's a full-on family house in South Africa. And there we just literally list it, put the price, Airbnb takes their fee, and that's that. If there's anything maintenance that needs to be done, it's like they just contact us on WhatsApp and it's sorted or through Airbnb. But there's none of the additional hands-on or additional licensing. What is the reason for that here in Japan?
That really depends on who you ask. The official story is that it's to regulate the industry, to make it less risky and make sure that people don't have accidents and that everyone's registered and accountable for whatever they do with the property. I would say it's probably a mix of the hotel lobby is pretty powerful in Japan and they've exerted some serious influence to make sure that the people who come to stay here, because especially with the Olympics that was coming up and the Rugby World Cup before that, there was a lot of need for budget accommodation. And Airbnb really flourished here in the 2 years leading into that. And I think the hotel lobby just got a bit freaked out by that. So they did what they could through their lobbyists. And the other thing is that Japanese people can be quite foreigner shy, to put it gently. And when they see foreigners running around the building, you know, obviously not all guests know exactly what to do with the rubbish, what goes out and what day and what color bag, and they speak foreign language in the hall, and they tend to be a bit louder than your average Japanese tenant.
Thank you.
And they just don't like that. It's a bit racist, but it's no different to any other place in the world. I mean, look at tourist locations like Venice and Italy or New York or a lot of other places. There are a lot of people complaining about the same sort of things, except they don't have the government backing. And here it's very easy for people to complain enough for the local city hall to then complain to the mayor's office. And then the mayor's office complains, enough mayors complain to the national government, and then a new legislation just comes in.
All right, so on to your next favorite episode. And this one, again, is another interview that I've done, this time with Ujjwal Vilagapudi from the U.S. And he is the host of a great little podcast named The Global Uj, which focuses on global entrepreneurship and the people founding and running these global companies all across the world. Now, he's actually in real estate himself, commercial real estate to be exact, and he wanted to know all about how we work here at NTI. So what kinds of clients do we serve, where do they come from, and how we can help them invest in and manage their properties remotely.
So we talk about structuring investment portfolios, recommending various locations all around the country, financing options, accessibility to foreign investors, and much, much more. So here's a small part of that conversation. And again, you can tune into the full conversation, which is over an hour long, by checking out the show notes, which we'll have a link to that episode as well. The thing is with Japan, like I said, so Tokyo, Osaka, Fukuoka, maybe Kyoto would have a few professionals that you can work with. But the further you get from those major city centers, the less and less local companies would be able to wrap their head around the concept of dealing with foreigners. Even if you do speak, read and write the language, just the fact that your name is foreign, that you're clearly not going to be in the vicinity of the property, they can't give you a call or send you a fax, which is still a big thing here in Japan for some reason, just turns them off the idea. So they tend to not even return emails or phone calls. They just don't know what to do when a foreigner contacts them. So I guess if you're purchasing one or two properties and it's only going to be in a major city, you could potentially get around working directly with companies on the ground. But if you're looking at a more diverse portfolio, a few socioeconomic profiles, a few locations around the country, or if you're looking for a holiday home in the countryside, there isn't the infrastructure here to help foreigners do that. So that's when they contact us.
And so which part of Japan do you tend to focus on? Where are you guys based out of, and do you like a specific market, or do you work in a certain zone, or is it really throughout the country?
Business-wise, we're nationwide. We're based in Fukuoka in southwestern Japan, which is sort of like the biggest metropolitan center closer to Southeast Asia. So Taiwan, Korea, some parts of China are actually closer to us than Tokyo is. And we live here because, I mean, we started visiting here when we opened the business about 9 years ago, simply because at that point in time, that's where the best deals were. And now that's sort of shifted to other locations, again, depending on investor criteria, but we really love the place. So we just stuck around personally. But we work nationwide. We would recommend to steer away from places that are suffering from population decline or have only got a single industry. That might be a bit more difficult for resale and tenanting purposes down the track. But otherwise, it's up to the investor. So depending on where they come from, what their profile is, what exactly they're looking for in their portfolio, and what other investments they already have, then we would recommend particular cities or towns. So if they're looking more for yield, we'd probably stay away from the major cities, go to prefectural capitals or satellite cities up to an hour away from a major city. If they're happy with lower yields and they really want the most safe and stable and potential growth-oriented property, then we would probably recommend a major city like Tokyo, Osaka, Fukuoka, Nagoya, Kyoto, and so forth. So it really, I mean, we don't dictate, we just make recommendations. So it's up to the investor. We try to get an understanding of what the rest of the portfolio looks like, whether it's real estate or not real estate, in which countries they are, what sort of yields as opposed to a capital growth potential they've got with their other investments, and then we try to complement that with whatever we can get for them here.
That's great. And so can we walk through how a typical buyer would come to you guys from the initial outreach all the way through setting up potentially a close and actually the management? Let's say we take myself, for example. I do have a real estate background within the U.S. I've worked primarily in commercial real estate investments, and I'm interested in investing globally. So I say, Ziv, I would like to invest in Japan. I have no clue about the market and no idea where to start. I'm assuming, you know, a lot of people that are my peers would, that have any interest to invest outside of the U.S. would truly not know a particular market very well, unless they really live there or have other business interests. So for example, for me, that would be the Japanese market. I've never visited. I don't know very much about it, but let's say I have interest in investing. Where would you steer me? I mean, how would you really guide me through the process? When I say I do want yield, can you tell me what that range would really look like? Two, I would want a few properties that are diversified. So instead of going to purchase one asset, I would want some sort of diversification in getting a group or getting multiple, like maybe a portfolio together. So how would you be able to guide someone like that?
Well, the first step would be to understand your budget and what yield actually means for you. So obviously, if your budget is just 100K, for example, there's a limit to the diversity that we can offer. So you'd be limited to mainly condo units or maybe a condo unit in the house. And you would be limited in your selection of locations as well. So, I mean, we often get approached by people who only have, say, 30-40K to invest. And there are properties in Japan that you can get that would generate rental income at 30-40,000, but they're not going to be in Tokyo, they're not going to be in Osaka, they're not going to be in Yokohama, Kawasaki, that sort of place. They're going to be in maybe Fukuoka or Nagoya, but more on the outer suburbs, not very central. So in that case, we would probably steer you towards prefectural capitals, and we would let you know that the maximum net pre-tax yield that you'll be able to get would be 8 or 9%. But you wouldn't have very good potential growth. If your budget is bigger, then we can start talking about diversity, and then we can say, okay, well, maybe make 80% of your budget a sort of safe and stable blue chip kind of property in a big central location, and then be a bit more adventurous with the remaining budget in another location, maybe get your rental income potentially higher, but you'll be losing out a little bit on the regrowth potential and so forth. So we would first try to get an idea of what you can budget for, and then based on that, we'll tell you what's achievable or not achievable within that budget. And it depends on where you're coming from, too. I mean, you're coming from the USA and commercial property, so I'm guessing it's a relatively high-yield environment compared to, say, a customer who comes from Singapore or Australia, where if you get 3, 4%, that's usually as high as it's going to go. So for those kind of customers, maybe 5-6% is already acceptable. It's higher than what they can get in their own backyard. But if you're coming from the USA or certain countries in Europe, you might not be satisfied with anything less than 7-8%, in which case we'd direct you in a right. different location.
Okay. And so let's say I do have a certain budget in mind. I come to you guys. We find a few different properties or a few different locations. How does financing work in Japan, especially for a foreign investor?
Well, until about 2 years ago, that wasn't even an option for non-residents. Now there are a few options open. There are companies in Japan that will lend to non-residents if they set up a Japanese company for the purpose of servicing the loan. But then, of course, companies come with an annual upkeep cost, so you have to make sure that your annual income justifies the $2,000 or $3,000 that will cost you in accounting and bookkeeping and corporate tax and so forth a year. And then there's at least one more company that I'm aware of which services Hong Kong or Taiwanese or Chinese residents, and they don't necessitate setting up a company in Japan. There's another one in Singapore that also services non-residents, but only for individual condos, so you wouldn't be able to use them to purchase a building. And the terms are quite similar for all of them, so they're something between 60 to 70% LTV, and somewhere between 3 to 4% annual interest.
Oh, wow, okay.
But their criteria is pretty strict, so you can only purchase in, well, pre-COVID it was central Tokyo, central Osaka, central Fukuoka. These days it's mostly just Tokyo, Yokohama maybe. Hopefully that'll ease up again, but that really limits your selection, and they also would not allow you to be creative with tenanting. So they appoint their own designated property manager who will only let you lease out to standard long-term Japanese tenants. Which obviously reduces your potential yield because you can't do any short-term rentals, Airbnb, commercial rentals, anything of that sort. It has to be strictly residential and strictly long-term leases.
Wow, that is really interesting. So would you say most of your buyers are cash buyers that are looking to invest?
Almost all of them, yeah. We now have, for the first time in 9 years, we now have a handful of people who've actually purchasing with loans. But yeah, 99% of them are cash buyers.
Okay. And you mentioned some of the different yields and different rates in the other countries. How would I mean, based on that, I'm assuming you have less traffic from American buyers, let's say, especially coming from the commercial world.
Not recently.
Do you see that?
No, we had when we started out, it was like that. So post GFC, America had a plethora of good deals. People could find distressed properties, high yielding properties, in a lot of spaces around the country. As things improved in the U.S. since 2015 or 16 or so, we started seeing a lot more traffic coming in from the U.S., Canada as well, which wasn't the case in previous years. I'm guessing this is because the market sort of dried up as far as high yields go. So they did start looking at overseas properties. And these days, I think maybe 30% of our clientele is North American. With the rest of them, about half of them are still Australia and Singapore, because those are places that have always been quite unaffordable and quite low on the yield. So they've always been internationally savvy and looking for opportunities abroad. And the rest are sort of bit of European, some Asian, Thailand, Malaysia, New Zealand, a few other countries. But more and more U.S. and Canada these days, actually.
Okay. And so when you find, let's say, depending on that certain buyer's profile and their criteria, if they have such a unique criteria and profile, how are you able to find the resources to be able to actually make that transaction happen? Let's say you're outside of your network or the major cities that you've formerly worked in. Are you having to find a brand new agent in the new city, property management company, the title company? I mean, all those folks from end to end, those vendors, is that a brand new search and effort for your team as well?
Yeah, but this is what we do on a regular basis. So we would, obviously, if we worked with a particular agent in the past, then they'll be sending us their listings before they actually hit the MLS websites, so we can get our foot in the door quicker. And some of them are national companies. So if we tell a national Japanese real estate agency that we're looking for properties in this and that particular location, then they would be able to contact a local office, maybe not in that city, but in a nearby city who handles that area and help us find listings. And if we can't get it through our already established channels, then we just go online like everybody else does. And once we've done one or two deals with a particular agent, once we've placed one or two tenants with a particular property manager, then we've got that city covered. We will try to expand our network just so that we have an alternative in case for some reason they can't serve us or they don't serve us as well as they used to. But depending on the city, I mean, the bigger cities would have more alternatives. In some cities, there's only one or two agents that we can work with. So we work with what we have.
So that was our conversation with Ujjwal Velagapudi of the Global Uj podcast. Again, a really good podcast with some great guests being interviewed on a regular basis. Highly recommend you check it out. Now for our next conversation, and we're almost done now, only two or three segments to go. This one's a chat that we had with a Japanese resident, originally from the USA, who's planning to purchase a home to live in Tokyo. And we were discussing everything to do with property due diligence for owners, occupiers. So purchase costs, insurance, and deductibles in case of insurance claims, zoning regulations, and a whole lot more. And this segment of the conversation focuses mainly on insurance and also on the difference between official tax evaluations and market price. Now, many of our listeners, again, have found this episode quite interesting based on download numbers. So here's that portion of the conversation again for you.
So I have a couple questions. So the fire insurance, is that included in the purchase cost?
The insurance is something that we take into account on the upkeep or management, not for purchase costs.
Okay.
It is cheaper. So it is cheaper if you purchase it 5 years in advance. So then it would be an expense that you would be paying on purchase, but then every 5 years you have to pay it again. So we factor it in under management.
Oh, I see. Okay, because I was looking at some other YouTube videos, and they actually calculated the fire insurance into the purchase cost, and it was like 250,000 yen. And I was wondering if that I was thinking, wow, is that for the like 1 year, 2 years? So I was wondering if that's I didn't see the insurance in your example, but I have seen insurance calculated into the purchase cost in other examples on YouTube.
Well, I mean, factoring it into the purchase cost is a little bit misleading because it's not an expense that is just a one-off. You do have to renew it every 5 years. I'll just have a quick look at something similar that we've helped somebody purchase recently, and I'll tell you what the insurance. I think, from memory, I think that's probably a 5-year policy, but just give me a split sec. I'll just quickly have a look.
I mean, if I'm just using that that example that I told you about, 250,000 yen, and if in fact it is a 5-year policy, that means the monthly bill would be like $42 or like 4,100 yen. Does that kind of sound correct?
Monthly.
Yeah.
If
you use 250,000 over 60 months.
Yes, I think that's about right. But I'm really trying to open this Excel. Oh, here it comes. Hang on. He's almost with us. Okay, so I'm looking at a structure that is 125 meters in size. So slightly larger than yours. Yours was 91 from memory.
Yes, that's right.
And he's paying for insurance. He's paying 8,600 a month. So yes, I think the four to 5,000 sounds reasonable for your size structure.
Okay.
So that's most likely they factored in 5 years of fire insurance. But again, I wouldn't count it as a purchase cost because it's something that you'll have to pay again and again whenever it expires.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds good. So that's fire. Earthquake insurance is a different insurance, right?
No, that's included.
Oh, that's included.
Yeah, so fire, earthquake, and other natural disasters are usually all the single policy.
Okay.
It also covers tsunami to the extent that tsunamis are usually caused by earthquakes, so they fall under the earthquake damages. The coverage is never 100%, though, so you might be looking at something like 60, 70%. Again, it varies depending on the official evaluation, but you're not looking at 100% coverage in most cases. Bringing it up to 100% or close to it would usually cost a lot more. So the frame of thinking is that by the time anything happens, you'd hopefully have already gotten some value out of the property by then.
I see. Are there any deductibles on these insurance policies?
They're all deductible. All of your purchase costs are deductible.
Oh, I'm sorry. I mean, like, you know, like in America, on certain incidences, I would have to pay, like, I don't have it in front of me, but like, I think it's hurricane, maybe. Hurricane, I'd have to pay the first $3,000. And then after I pay that first $3,000, then the insurance will kick in. That's the deductible.
Oh, you mean your excess? Okay. Yes. Yes. That applies to these policies as well. It depends again. Oh, okay. Depends again on the individual policy and the property, but there's always a certain amount that you'll have to pay out of pocket, yes. But it's usually going to be minute compared to the coverage.
Okay, I got, yeah, well, yeah, like, I don't know if $3,000 is minute compared to my coverage. I haven't used it yet, so I'm not really sure. Yeah, I know they do have deductibles in America, so it's the same in Japan. So, Ziv, I wanted to ask you, since you were talking about, like, a lot of these things are, like, dependent on the valuation. I heard that came up in our conversation a lot. So, with the valuation, I know, I believe the city ward offices determine that valuation.
Correct. When they issue your property tax statement every year, then they'll base the property tax on what they believe the valuation is. And that'll appear in the statement.
Yeah. So, like, for example, in America, you can go online and you can go to any county. Like my property is in a county. I can go to that county, website and I can look up, you know, I can punch in the address and it's public record for all those properties in the county to show how much, the property taxes were, in 2019, 18. I don't know how far back it goes, but you can see it. That's public information. Is that the same in Japan?
It is public information, but it's not as easily accessible. Japan being Japan, a lot of it is not online still. And Tokyo might be a bit different. I think there are some resources in Tokyo that you can access online. But in any case, you can always just stroll over to the local ward office and ask to receive those historical statements. They're always available.
Oh, okay. That you can't get. Yeah, because, yeah, I was, you know, because that seems to be like the mystery key. Because I hear that in a lot of other videos, they're like, oh, it all depends on the valuation. And I just thought to myself, well, the valuations in America, you can see them very easily. That's so even before you purchase, you can go online. Even if I, like, I'm thinking of buying something in Washington, America, in Washington State, in Clark County. And if you go to the Clark County website, you can punch in the address. All the information comes up. It shows the last purchase price and so on and so forth. So I was wondering if, you know, if that, but thank you for responding to that. I mean, it's not readily available online yet, but if I go to the office. So, yeah, so if I went to the county office and then I asked them, you know, like to see the property tax for 2019, I could get that information.
You could, but if you're looking at a particular property, the easiest route would be to just ask the seller and the realtor to provide the last statements.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because that would give me, because I heard on some podcasts or some YouTube videos that the you know, it's the sales price and the actual price that they use to calculate the property taxes can be really can be a huge difference.
Correct.
Have you seen that in the past?
Yes, that's very correct. It's usually they reevaluate every few years and then they run averages. So the closer you are to the last calculation, the more accurate it would be. But there's always at least a slight difference, and particularly in areas which have gone up or down in value, but the government valuations haven't quite caught up with market price yet. And then you could see some very big differences.
But in general, is the property calculation for the property taxes lower than the sales price or higher?
Depends on what's happened in the area. So we've seen, for example, Sapporo, for example, took a hit after the 2011 and the Fukushima thing.
Uh-huh.
And there we saw quite high property tax statements and quite high evaluations because the market took a hit, but the government haven't updated yet.
Okay.
And in other places, let's say Fukuoka, which is sort of a rising star, it was the other way around. So the official eval haven't quite caught up with market prices, which were shooting up.
I see.
So it really depends on the location. In Tokyo specifically, they probably got their finger on the pulse a little bit more. So the difference would be smaller, but it would definitely exist always. Yes.
I got it. So, I know we're on 30 minutes. So I just want to, so say for example, I go through the purchase and then, you know, the purchase came out to 13% of the sales price. Then, you know, I paid the realtor's fee, the legal and all the registration things. I hired you guys, for example, to help me with the legal documentation. So once all of that is clear, I get the keys, the title, and the deed to the property is in my hand. So after that, you know, like, so the monthly, of course, I'll have the mortgage fee, but what other fees will come on every month? Like, so the property tax, obviously, that, you know, that would be calculated later, and either I pay my property taxes in America twice a year, so I don't know how they're going to calculate that, but I'm sure that'll be a cost that'll be coming up either monthly, annually or semi-annually.
Well, they give you a statement which you can pay in one bulk payment, or you can do it quarterly. It's up to you.
Okay. So besides the loan and the property tax, what are other reoccurring costs that will come up every month? Like, is there anything else that you can think of besides the property tax and the loan?
Not if you own the entire structure, no. The only thing would be maintenance, which, again, if you're buying new for the first 10 years, there'd be very little of that. Depending on whether, I don't know if, I mean, the one you sent to me only has a little garage parking concrete slab, but if you've got obviously any lawn or trees or anything, there might be a bit of gardening. But otherwise, no, just normal living expenses, you know, internet, utilities, that sort of thing.
Oh, okay. And, you know, so I see a lot of these properties that are either they're being torn down and rebuilt, sometimes in you know, like next to older homes. Are there any like red flags or anything that you would say be cautious about? Like if, you know, like your house is brand new and the adjacent lots are not new, or the right side you have a small little company and the left side you have like another property owner. Are there any kind of red flags that I know there needs to be a certain distance from your, there needs to be a certain amount of meters between you and the road.
Well, that's only an issue if you buy secondhand, because then if you buy something that's 20 or 30 years old, then zoning regulations might have changed since build.
Yes.
But if you're buying something new, that's obviously been built based on current regulations. So that's not going to be an issue. When you rebuild down the track, if regulations have changed, then you might need to leave the base intact and reconstruct on top of the existing concrete base, which would make it a renovation rather than a rebuild. And then you wouldn't necessarily have to comply with new building regulations.
Okay.
But I mean, I don't think they're going to change hugely in the big cities. They have changed a bit in the last 20, 30 years. But these days, if the property was built in the last, say, 5 or 6 years, then that's not going to be an issue at all, no.
All right, so we're almost done now. This next to last conversation that you've also downloaded hundreds of times, and one that we've had with a couple from the US again, and they have a son living here in Japan and are interested in potentially getting a business manager visa granted to them based on their future property investments here in Japan. So we had a short chat on that topic, mainly what sort of investment capital you'd need to put in, what level of income you'd need to generate to qualify for these visas, and also what property profiles would satisfy the requirements for them. So Japan doesn't have straightforward investment visas like many other countries do, but it is possible to set up a property management or asset management company that could potentially help non-resident investors get a business visa. So this conversation is all about business visas, the types of properties, which one would need to focus on buying and managing to qualify for them, and the costs and processes involved. Hope you enjoy it.
We're not connected to the US anymore. Part of our journey, we detached from all unnecessary possessions. We were minimalist. Yeah. And so we can now restructure our lives so we can go anywhere we want to go. And we want to try living some other lifestyle, some other places,
yep,
some other economies. And Japan is at the top of the list. Asia is at the top of the list. Malaysia, we like South Korea. We want to explore Malaysia. But Japan, because of our family being there, would be a choice. Yes.
Well,
I don't know what advice you have for that, or what services you have for that. Well,
let's maybe tackle that visa thing first, because that would also dictate the sort of investments that you'd be looking at generally. We can give you general advice, but I think our strength is probably in just connecting you to the right professionals and then facilitating the connection so that they can help you more efficiently than we can. So we're not accountants, we're not immigration lawyers, we're not property or company set up lawyers, but we can definitely organize the team and work with them on your behalf. So again, bearing in mind that I'm not an immigration lawyer, the general gist of things seems to be that you can get a business manager visa if you set up a business that deals directly with real estate management, portfolio management, building maintenance, building management, that sort of thing. It's not going to be strictly by the virtue of owning an investment. So if you own a large portfolio, even of 30 or 50 doors, but they're all individual units in different locations or even a few in the same building, that's not going to justify a real estate management company setup. So you do have to own multifamily structures, an actual building or two or three. And whether it's one or two or three would depend on the income that they generate. So to qualify for a business visa, from memory, last time I checked with an immigration lawyer, you were supposed to net about 2.5 million yen per annum. So about $23,000. And then if you've got other dependents, then each of those dependents would double or triple the amount of income that you'd need to generate. So for you and Kim, you'd need about 5 million.
Okay.
And then
the business has to maintain that steady level of income over time. So it's all good and well to apply for the visa claiming that you're going to be make, but then every year they're going to check that you're actually netting that. And normally when you purchase an investment property, you would want to be claiming the purchase costs and carrying them forward. For individuals, you can do that for 3 years. For companies, you can do that for 5 years. But you'd have to strike a balance, and that's where your accountant and your immigration lawyer would have to communicate with each other. You'd have to strike a balance that guarantees that the net income after you've claimed everything that you want to claim is sufficient to maintain your visa. All right, so there's a bit of a balancing act there. On the one hand, you want to claim as much as possible tax-wise, but on the other hand, you want to be making enough net income so that you keep qualifying for the visa and moving forward. And of course, the other thing is that you have to make sure that the property that you're purchasing generates enough income for that purpose. So if you're purchasing, say, a 4 or 6 unit multifamily building, it might be, if we put all the deductions and claims aside, and let's say we're not doing any of that, it might be generating, say, $2,500 a month or $3,000 a month. That might qualify you for the one visa, but probably not for both of them. So you'd probably want to look at having two of these buildings. Okay. And at the moment, buildings in good locations, especially around Tokyo, Osaka, Yokohama, Kobe, and the satellite cities around there, and Nagoya as well, they have taken a hit with Corona. So there are deals that are more attractive than we've seen, say, in the past 4 or 5 years. But still, the entry level for a multifamily building is probably not going to be lower than 30 million or 35 million yen.
Okay.
So if you're looking at a cash investment, and we can discuss potential financing a little bit later, but if you're looking at a cash investment, you're looking at something like $600,000 to buy two of those buildings that would potentially satisfy two visa requirements. So that's a bit of a different picture from the properties that you have been looking at that we've been forwarding to you, because these are all individual units under 100K, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and those are very helpful to see, you know, what the building is, you know, an apartment, the size of the apartment. Looking at the Goya one and looking at the cash flow, the monthly fees and so forth.
Right.
So the fee structure would be different for buying a whole building, I would imagine, or would it just be per unit roughly the same?
The fee structure as in our fees, you mean?
The monthly cost for running a whole building.
Well, both the purchase costs and the monthly costs tend to decrease percentage-wise as the asset value and the income gets higher. So with us, for example, we'd be charging 2%. The property managers usually charge 4 or 5%. Purchase costs for individual units tend to hover around somewhere. This is all assuming that you're using our services, not directly with the realtor. So usually purchase costs would be hovering for individual units at somewhere between 17 to 18%. We like to estimate a worst case scenario of 20%.
Yeah,
but with buildings, it could drop down to potentially 15, 13, 10, or 11%. The bigger and more expensive the building is, the less it's going to cost percentage-wise.
Yeah.
And the management costs, again, to a point, I mean, our fees are slightly lower for bigger properties. Property managers tend to charge about the same. It might be 1% lower on the management cost. Insurance is actually slightly higher if you own the entire structure, because you need structural insurance as well, not just the interior. But insurance is usually a minute expense in Japan. Just trying to think.
I guess it seems like a way to really streamline the purchase cost. You know, if I buy four separate units somewhere, closing costs, purchase costs for each one of those units versus buying a whole building, a 4 to 6 unit building, there's one-time transaction cost. Seems like there has to be a savings there.
The transaction cost is slightly lower, but it's mainly a case of
the purchase tax and the legal registration tax being a factor of the official evaluation of the property price. And that does tend to be lower percentage-wise for bigger and more expensive properties. So we're looking at a difference of, for larger buildings, it's usually somewhere between 1 to 3%, whereas for individual units, it usually ends up being something like 4 or 5%.
And for our last segment in this compilation, drum roll. This one was actually our last episode in 2020 as well. And surprisingly enough, or at least surprising for me, because it was actually a bit more negative in tone compared with everything that we usually talk about, it was also one of your favorite episodes of the year. And this is the one in which we speak about what you can expect from us as proxies, buyer advocates, and portfolio managers, but perhaps more importantly, what you shouldn't be expecting from us. And this remains a really important topic to discuss because with the market and business environment here in Japan being in many cases vastly different from what our clients may be used to, we often get asked if we handle everything on their behalf. And while the answer is yes, we definitely can and do, this doesn't mean that we can do it all on our own and for the same fixed price. So some services are performed, in fact, most services are performed by third parties. And most of them cost money, as they would if you were to order them from those third parties directly on your own. So here's a segment from our final episode of 2020, which is really all about what we cannot, should not, or will not do on behalf of our clients. So it's really important when a company starts a relationship with a new client for both sides to be aware of what exactly is included in the services that are going to be provided. And equally important, both sides need to be clear on what's not included. Simply because if that's not laid out and clear from the get-go, it can lead to disappointments or even disputes down the track. And we, like most professional companies, prefer our clients well-informed, well in advance of hiring our services to avoid this exact sort of situation. And also to let the client know what to expect from us and at what price. And also what, if anything, they'll need to hire other professionals for or pay separate fees for. So you already know what we are. We're buyers, agents, proxies, but here's what we're not. So we're not realtors and we're not property managers. We work with third parties for both of these services. And the advantage is that this gives us the ability to be completely interest-free as far as representing our clients goes. So we have no vested interest in any particular properties, any particular areas for you to buy in, and no vested interest in working with any particular tenant bases, with any particular renovation or repair companies, which many property managers do. We are 100% on the buyer or seller side, depending on who it is that we've been hired to represent. And if we happen to represent both, which is sometimes the case when, for example, one of our clients wants to sell a property and another one of our clients wants to buy it, and in those cases, we won't even have to work with a realtor, and that does save a few bucks. So the buyer and seller would both be our clients, and they can expect the same level of professional advice and services to be facilitated on both their behalves. And our clients who sell property know very well, if we believe that a property that they're selling is not really an attractive deal anymore, and this can happen for any number of reasons, because building management has gone downhill or building fees have gone up, a particular area might be less attractive than it was when they purchased, or the property has gotten too old since it was purchased, so it doesn't really generate the same stable and reliable income it used to, we'll immediately let them know that we won't be recommending that particular property to any of our clients. So we're still more than happy to help them sell it, but it'll be on the open market using a realtor, and it'll most likely be sold to a local Japanese buyer or a local property company who might be interested in it for various other reasons, aside from the straightforward investment vehicle value. We are also not accountants, so we can be your bookkeepers for all matters related to your property portfolio income and expenses, but not anything else. And if you don't live in Japan and you don't have a bank account here, will most likely have to take care of your income collections and expenses payments for you, and that is included in our monthly charges, which means that we'll also provide you with an annual statement and we'll send funds back to you, of course, at your request. And we'll even advise on exchange rates, depending on which country and which currency you'll be withdrawing your funds into. But we're not accountants. And that means that aside from some general guidelines as to tax brackets and individual versus company ownership of properties, depreciation considerations, and so forth, we would always advise that you consult with an accountant based on your own private circumstances. And for that same reason, because we're not accountants, we also can't file your tax return statements for you.
neither here in Japan and, of course, not in any other country. So you will need an accountant for that as well if you don't do it yourself and if you're over the reporting threshold. And accountants obviously charge for their services as they normally do for consultations. What else are we not? We're not property lawyers. We're not immigration lawyers. We're not solicitors. We can't represent you in court. We can't take care of your visa applications, business related or otherwise. And we can't conduct property transactions on your behalf without a property lawyer. We can and are regularly managing those lawyers on your behalf. We provide them with the documentation they need. We pay the court or the legal registration fees as required from your account held by us on your behalf. And we can even help you shop around for the best lawyer to suit your requirements when that's necessary, and even replace them if they fail to perform, same as we do with any other service providers. But we cannot act instead of a lawyer. We are also not certified translators. And even on an ad hoc level, we won't be translating all of the Japanese documentation involved in the purchase, the sale, and the management for you. What we do as your proxies and as your advisors is we give you summaries and bottom lines to the best of our understanding. And in some cases, like in the case of purchase and sale contracts or property spec documents or insurance policies, for example, there's a huge amount of industry-specific information in these documents that we wouldn't presume to have a deep understanding of, let alone the ability to professionally review and translate into English for you. So we can tell you, for example, how much the legal and registration fees are for a particular property and if they're within reason based on our experience, or how much the annual premiums are for an insurance policy, what the maximum coverage is. And we can definitely tell you whether that particular insurance company has been relatively easy to deal with when a claim does need to be processed. But we will not be able to let you know exactly how the legal fees or total coverage of the insurance is derived. We know that it's generally based on the property's official evaluations, but we're not insurance actuaries. And again, we're not accountants. And don't forget that also property official evaluations, as they show up on tax statements, are not extremely clear. They're comprised of quite a few different components that an accountant can sort of add up for you and let you know what the total is. And that total evaluation is normally going to be quite different to the market price, as we've mentioned here many times in the past. But for these exact calculations, you will have to communicate directly with an accountant or a legal professional in the case of legal contracts. And in all likelihood, you will have to pay them for their time if you do so. We can save you that hassle and expense based on our experience by telling you, again, in bottom lines, what to expect in each and every scenario to the best of our experience. But we cannot interpret legal documents or complex financial calculations such as insurance companies, insurance policies and tax returns on your behalf. This is not what we do. Similarly, we're not building inspectors. We're not zoning regulators. We can communicate with these professionals on your behalf if you have need of them. We're not asset managers, but we can appoint asset managers for you and we can supervise their work. We're not developers or resort operators, but we can research good companies for you to work with in areas where that's possible. And we can manage the relationship for you and so on and so forth. So we're your arms and your legs here in Japan, and we generally have a very good understanding and professional know-how on how to represent you to the best and most profitable results. But we're not a certified jack of all trades who can do anything. We're portfolio managers, we're proxies, we're project managers, we can put together a good team, we can manage them for you. We cannot replace them or act instead of them.
So there you have it. If you've made it this far, well, for one, we're really grateful. If you sat through 2 hours of this podcast, it definitely means that you're finding our content valuable, which is a huge compliment for us. So again, thank you. And it also probably means that you're well and truly interested in Japan's real estate property market. And if this is the case, and if you're looking for more information, please do remember that we're always happy to talk shop, as you've probably noticed listening in on all of these conversations that we've had with clients and potential clients and other interviewers and interviewees and industry professionals. So don't be shy. As always, drop us a line and let's book a day and time to talk about whatever happens to be on your mind. And if you're on Clubhouse, look me up there and follow me to get notice whenever I speak to any of the rooms there. These will mainly be Q&A sessions, so probably just what you're looking for. We've currently got a regular Wednesday room at 1:30 Japan Standard Time. And we'll soon probably start guest starring on some other global real estate rooms. If you need a Clubhouse invite, drop me a line and I'll try to sort you out. And this is also the perfect time to remind you that if you, like that lovely couple from the USA that we just heard from a couple of segments ago,
if you're interested in migrating to Japan or changing over from one visa to another or starting a business or a company here in Japan, our sponsor, Hiroshi Shimizu, is very approachable and a very affordable immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener, and he can happily and efficiently help you with all of these needs. He's already done exactly that for many of our listeners and clients. So feel free to reach out to Shimizu-san on info@h-shimizu-office.com. Or just pick up the phone, give him a call on 092-732-7755. Or if you're calling from out of Japan, that's +81 92 732 7755. And also, if you've got a product or service or project that you'd like more English speakers in Japan or English speakers who are interested in Japan to know about, drop us a line and we'll share our sponsorship programs with you. They're very affordable and they'll give you immediate exposure to thousands of Japan-centric ears every month. So that's it for our very long and information-packed compilation episode of the year. Hope you've enjoyed it. Again, all of the links to the full episodes will be in the show notes. Feel free to dive into any of them if you liked what you heard on these shorter segments. And of course, do share the podcast and this episode with your own networks. Give us a star rating or a review on the iTunes store, or just let us know what you thought in the comment section or wherever you might have found us. Hope to have you with us again next time on the Japan Real Estate Podcast. And until then, yoroshiku.